Welcome to A Christian and an Atheist Walk into a Bar. I'm one of your co-hosts, Phil Thompson, and I am playing the role of the Christian.
I'm Neil Newton, and I don't know if I'm playing the role of the atheist. It just happens.
We keep threatening to change roles here, so that has to happen sometime. And like Samson, my arguments are going to be much weaker because I have shaved my beard, which I wore for 30 years. The whole time I've lived in Pittsburgh, by the way. So none of the people that I've known in a decent adult life in Pittsburgh have ever seen clean-shaven Phil. And I shaved my beard this past Saturday thinking, well, summer's coming. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this because I don't want to get a tan on my cheeks and then shave my beard off. And that would look very, very weird. And I did it. And now it is like 50 degrees and cold and gray in Pittsburgh on Memorial Day weekend 2021. And I'm feeling the cold air on my face.
Yeah, it's what most people refer to as beard weather, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like it's perfect beard weather right now. And yeah. I no longer have, actually, I never had the perfect beard. But do I have the perfect beer?
Oh, yeah. What are you drinking this week?
So in our bar, I am drinking Double-Edged Sword, which is a double IPA from Grist House, which is a Pittsburgh brewery. This is a very cool can with double griffins on either side of a sword. This is 8% alcohol, so we'll see how coherent I am by the time we get to the end of the podcast. It's been a while since I've had a beer that was that potent. Anyway. There it is. Okay, I like it. Very good. Well, how about you, Neil? What are you drinking?
Water. I'm actually on water tonight.
Because you're going to an LAFC game later on.
I am cycling to that straight after this, so that's like one reason. That's not the main reason, because I will have a beer there and cycle home. But actually, I won't this week, because the other reason is I'm on antibiotics as well.
Oh, so, you're on antibiotics, so you haven't been feeling well.
And no, I was bitten by a spider.
Yikes.
Yeah, I assume I never saw the spider, but it was an insect bite. It was larger than normal.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, that's weird. That's quite a lump for an insect bite. And then 2 days later, it was larger still. Yeah. And I was like, that's not a good thing. I looked up and with spider bites, if after 48 hours, it's still getting worse, then you should see a doctor.
Right.
And so I saw the doctor and he said, occasionally what happens is when you get bitten, there's bacteria on your skin or something, and the bacteria goes under the skin and you get like a skin infection essentially. So I was given antibiotics for that, which was good because my body was apparently not winning.
Right.
And even after it took about 2 days of the antibiotics for it actually to start decreasing.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that's gone in the right direction.
I think about this, like if this was pre-antibiotics, would I die? Like,
there'd be a real chance.
From this minor scratch?
Or would they put leeches on you or cut off your arm or wherever it was you got bit?
But that's why I'm not drinking.
Okay. So, Neil, do you want to introduce this week's topic? Yeah,
I guess I accidentally sent us down this path. We're looking at Tolstoy's The Gospel in Brief, which I didn't finish, but I read enough of it.
Okay.
because it was a slog, Phil. It was a slog.
It was, and I want to underscore that it was a slog, and it was your idea. So...
But you know, Tolstoy is a very respected writer. I like Dostoevsky a lot. I've never actually read any Tolstoy. I know Dostoevsky was a fan of The Gospel in Brief. Now that I've read it, I'm a little confused because it doesn't match with his theology completely.
It doesn't match with Dostoevsky's theology, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Also, it just didn't seem well written to me. So but he found something he liked in it regardless. So I took his recommendation and thought it could be a fun thing to read. And it has definitely a lot of things to talk about, doesn't it?
It does have a lot of things to talk about. I did finish it. I did manage to make it all the way through, mostly because my work year in my academic setting is done now, and I'm a free man until August. So I actually had some time when I was awake to read, because I did find that if I was not like feeling fairly awake when I started reading this, I immediately started falling asleep. And not every book has to be thoroughly engaging, but it was a difficult read. But I also agree that you don't really need to finish it to understand where he's coming from and what he's doing, because my quibbles aren't with any particular thing that he says. It's basically the teachings of the gospel without any of the things that people would consider miracles or supernatural.
I guess we should define that's your point. You have quibbles with this.
Well,
is that's your starting, that's your overall kind of feeling.
I mean, that's not my quibble. That's just my description, I think. And I think that matches Tolstoy's description. He says in the preface, there are no miracles, there are no exorcisms, there's no healings or walking on the water or that kind of thing. And he's very straightforward about all of that from his perspective being added later on to prove that Jesus was divine, and that in his opinion, you didn't need the divinity for the teachings to make sense. It's a really interesting combination to me. You know, he's compiling this in the late 19th century. On the one hand, his perspective that he's bringing to it is a very materialistic one, which is that the universe is a closed system. And if there are things that we might consider miracles, they're just things that we don't understand rationally or scientifically yet. I think that's a fair way of describing his, you know, so like from his perspective, the miracles don't happen, and it's just superstition that was added to this amazing teacher, you know.
Sure.
And another thing that he says is that he wants to embrace the teaching of Jesus. He does embrace the teaching of Jesus as he understands it. He's not diminishing that. He's saying his teaching is so amazing, and that's why the church springs up, because of his teaching, not because of these ideas about the divinity of Jesus or about any kind of supernatural works of power that Jesus may have done. So he strips away all of what are called, for better or worse, I'm going to argue in a little bit that for worse, miracles or supernatural acts, and just leaves us with his version of the teaching. So, like, on the one hand, it's very materialistic, right? He's bringing a very 19th century, post-Enlightenment, materialist mindset to how he's reading scripture, which fit certainly with the textual criticism that was emerging in theology at that time, particularly in Europe. His approach to the gospel is actually very similar to Thomas Jefferson's Bible.
Okay.
Yeah. Where Jefferson in, I think, like 1803 or something like that, does almost the exact same thing, except he just takes the manuscript and he cuts the chunks out and lays the teachings of Jesus all together. And he keeps the text as it is, but he just leaves out all of the things that don't fit with his view of the Enlightenment. You know, so there's a very strong connection between what Tolstoy does and what Jefferson does, right? In terms of, like, we're just going to take the teachings, we're going to leave out all of that supernatural, superstitious nonsense, and this is the Jesus that we embrace. And much like Jefferson, he does embrace his particular version of Jesus.
Yeah. And I have a lot of questions about that, actually, as someone who's never actually read the Bible and will probably never read the Bible. There's things that caught my interest from reading Tolstoy's Gospel Brief. Well, maybe we'll start from a literary point of view. Are the Gospels kind of laid out in the same way? Basically, this happened, he said this happened, in this very kind of dour fashion?
I would say no, you know, because he takes out a lot of the narrative threads.
I see. There's something I was wondering about, because it does seem just very much like a catalogue of things in the Tolstoy.
Right. And there is, especially in earlier manuscripts that were circulating, there are these lists of sayings of Jesus that were circulating.
I see.
Probably before the Gospels, as we know them, the four Gospels that are part of the Christian canon, were formulated. I mean, the most famous one is the Gospel of Thomas, which is not canonical, but a lot of the sayings that are in the canonical Gospels are in the Gospel of Thomas. So there were these sayings that were circulating, but the Gospels themselves have a strong narrative thread, and each one has its very own perspective. And especially like Matthew, Mark, Luke, which are considered the synoptic Gospels, and all seem to be based on the same collections of sayings. And then there's the Gospel of John, which is very different. You get a very different sense of the character of Jesus, but they are coherent in terms of their overall presentation of who Jesus is and how we're expected to relate to him. And a lot of the narrative has to do with the things that Jesus does, like he heals someone, he casts out a demon, he feeds the 5,000, he breaks bread. So in the Gospel of John, every teaching is connected to a particular miracle in a very tightly ordered way.
I see. I remember seeing that Tolstoy went back to the earliest documents he could find that he had access to, and he compared lots of early documents. And if you're saying that these were things added later, perhaps this is why Tolstoy's Gospel in Brief is as it is because he's gone to those earlier source documents.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of debate in terms of how much later. I'm not an expert in this, but for instance, like none of the Gospels mention the destruction of the temple, which was in 70 AD. That doesn't mean they were completed in their current-ish form by 70 AD, but it is really interesting. Some people date John's as the latest one. And, you know, that the church was already well split from Judaism at that point because it's some consider the portrayal of the Jews to be anti-Semitic in the Gospel of John. That's an argument. As a counter-argument, the Gospel of John is the most Jewish of all the Gospels in terms of how Jesus is presented and even the language that he uses. And some of that's been lost through translations over the years. I could go off for a long time on that. I'll try not to do that. but for instance, the Gospel of John opens with a kind of a recasting of the creation story. In the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word in the Greek, because it's written in Greek, John's Gospel, is Logos. This has caused confusion for a really long time because Logos, of course, the Greek word for logic or reason. So a lot of people, especially like Christian theologians, have interpolated rationalism, like Jesus as the embodiment of reason. But it turns out that Logos is actually the way the Greek translation of the Old Testament translates Torah. So actually, if you understand it in terms of the Septuagint, the very first line of the Gospel of John is, in the beginning was Torah, the law as given to Moses is the Torah.
Okay, I see.
So the miracle of the water being turned into wine in the Gospel of John, well, the cisterns that Jesus has the servants fill with water that he then turns into wine are cisterns where you would have the water for ritual purification. Mm-hmm. So it becomes this symbol. When Jesus takes the water for ritual purification and turns it into wine, it's very much saying Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. So it's a very Hebraic. There's so many things in the Gospel of John that are like extraordinarily embedded into a Hebrew worldview. And there are some scholars who argue that the Gospel of John is actually the earliest of the four Gospels. So dating can be tricky because there are arguments for and against earlier and later datings for all of the Gospels. And a lot of times, textual criticism, much like Tolstoy and much like Jefferson, is coming at it from the standpoint of skepticism. And that's fine so long as you're like self-aware about it, right?
Yeah, I almost don't see it as coming from skepticism. Around the same time, you got people like Frege or Bertrand Russell or people like this, and they're trying to build mathematics from the smallest units. Bertrand Russell, I think it's either with Moore or Whitehead, was working on proving 1 + 1 = 2, and it takes him 300 pages to do this in. But he's trying to find the most fundamental building blocks that we can say exist, and then we can build everything from this. Yeah. And Gottlieb Frege is doing exactly the same thing in Germany. He's trying to set about creating a very simple set of axioms which we can then build everything from. And I get the feeling that's a little bit what Tolstoy is trying to do as well. Like not necessarily a skepticism, but he's trying to find the smallest things that you need to trust yeah. and then build everything from that.
But I still think he has to impose a modernist mindset on the first century to do it. Yeah.
It is a modernist mindset to try and do that, to build everything from first principles. It was very much of that time. All those things were happening
right
around the turn of the late 19th, early 20th
right. century. And that was happening in theology as opposed to mathematics. The first thing, it seems to me, is understand the text on its own terms. Even if it's not part of your worldview as the interpreter, it was certainly not out of the realm of possibility in first century Judaism or Christianity for things that we would consider miraculous to happen. It wasn't considered commonplace. That's why they were understood as miracles. Right? something extraordinary that has happened that we don't have any particularly good understanding for. So I feel like the first thing is, are you understanding the text on its own terms before you bring your modernist assumptions to it? Are you understanding it on its own terms?
That's right.
I think probably not, but let's go with that. Let's take a modernist mindset and apply it to the Gospels. And then the thing is, well, does it hold together, you know, is it internally coherent? And I think that's where Tolstoy runs up against some problems. Tolstoy substitutes Jesus talking about himself for Jesus talking about his teaching.
Uh-huh.
And in some cases, that can work and you almost don't notice it. But in some cases, it's really obvious how strained his effort to demystify the Gospels is. Like, he retells the story of a man that was blind from birth that Jesus heals. Now, in the Gospel of John, chapter 9, if you're following along in your Bibles, it's a man that was born blind. He had been blind his whole life. Jesus sees the blind man. He heals the blind man. All of a sudden, the blind man can see for the first time. Everybody has known that he was blind his whole life. He goes to, I think it was a synagogue, and the leaders are like, you've been blind your whole life, and now you can see. How did this happen? Well, Jesus healed me, and now I can see. Well, the leaders in, this is in the Gospel of John, don't believe in Jesus, don't believe he's who he claims to be, are very wary of how many people are following him, and they're looking for any other possible explanation. And they're also upset because Jesus heals this man on the Sabbath, and so he's violated the prohibition against doing work on the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So it becomes about Jesus doing the work of God, but doing it on the Sabbath becomes a point of conflict between him and the leaders. This is all how it's told in the Gospel of John. Now, in Tolstoy's version, he substitutes blindness, actual physical blindness, as in I can't see with my eyes, for ignorance. The man had been ignorant his entire life, and Jesus enlightened him. And he tells the story almost verbatim, substituting ignorance for blindness and enlightenment for sight. And it just isn't internally coherent. It's very forced because, like, having a conversation with someone on the Sabbath wasn't prohibited. Like, there's no need for conflict around, oh, this guy has kind of a better perspective and he's not being ignorant. Well, like, whatever that meant. We don't even get a sense of what is meant by ignorance as opposed to enlightenment, except that somehow he embraced Jesus' teaching after this not miraculous conversation. Well, what's the actual source of conflict here? Except that they just disagree with Jesus. You don't get a sense reading Tolstoy's version that Jesus is actually a threat to anybody.
There's a couple of things. So one thing that stands out to me reading through Tolstoy's version, like I say, I've never read the other one, is Jesus comes across as a bit of a know-it-all.
Oh, yeah.
Is he a know-it-all in the real Bible as well? Like the one you...
He doesn't come off as a know-it-all, actually. Obviously, I'm biased. Reading Tolstoy's version, he comes off to me as like a daytime talk show host.
A little bit, yeah. Like that's exactly how he comes across.
Kind of a snake oil salesman, and he's one or two episodes away from doing paternity tests. And it reminded me of C.S. Lewis's liar, lunatic, or lord argument. For Jesus to make the claims he made about his divinity, about his authority to forgive people's sins, about his sacrifice providing salvation for the world, if he's not actually who he claims to be, the Son of God, then he's a liar or he's out of his mind, but he's not a great teacher. And weirdly, now the way theologians get around the argument a lot of times, they say, well, Jesus didn't really say those things. We don't know exactly what Jesus said and didn't say and what he did and didn't do because, you know, of how the Gospels were compiled. You know, that some theologians say that. Obviously, some theologians don't want to like look at that at all.
If you take that approach that you're saying, that means you're accepting implicitly that the text demonstrates him to be a bad teacher.
Lewis is basically saying, if Jesus isn't the Son of God who, through his work atoning and healing and redeeming the world, then he's a nut job and you shouldn't pay any attention to him.
I see.
That's a pretty strong argument to make. I don't want to begrudge anybody any sense of being moved by any of Jesus' teachings. Okay. You know, but I see when I read the Tolstoy, I'm like, that guy, no way I would follow that guy anywhere because he's a prick.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what I took from it too. But in the Tolstoy, Jesus appears to be a disciple of John who then got a bit big for his boots and decided he knew more than John.
Yeah.
So then started stealing John's followers? Is that kind of like...
It kind of comes off that way. In the Gospels, John understands that he is preparing the way for Jesus. He understands that he's the forerunner of Jesus. And so when Jesus shows up on the scene and starts his ministry, that John is more than happy to take a backseat. And then he's executed by Herod anyway. So he didn't have much of a choice in it. And Jesus has some of his most, the highest praise he gives to anyone is directed toward John, who he compares to Elijah, the great prophet of Israel. Okay. And there was a prophecy that before the Messiah came, Elijah had to return. And when they asked Jesus about this, but doesn't Elijah have to come first? And Jesus, confounding literalistic interpretations of prophecy, says, well, Elijah did come first. That was John the Baptist, and you people did whatever you wanted to him.
So another question I have based on Tolstoy is, does the New Testament really say you don't have to pray? That's pretty explicit in Tolstoy. He says, don't bother praying. Why would you even pray? Because God knows everything you're doing anyway. So like he already knows what you're thinking. So why would you waste time with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually didn't get that from the Tolstoy. The Gospels do say, Jesus does say, your heavenly Father already knows everything you need. But he also says, pray like you're trying to wake up your neighbor in the middle of the night because a guest came unexpectedly and you don't have any bread. Pray with that kind of urgency so that you're just going to keep knocking on your neighbor's door until your neighbor finally gets out of bed, you know, because you need some bread for your guest. They didn't have 24-hour grocers, so you went to your neighbor, right?
But they did have 24-hour guests, it turns out.
Yes. Well, it was the Middle East. The rules about accepting guests were pretty strict. But notice that Tolstoy does structure this whole thing around the Lord's Prayer.
He does, that's right.
You know, so he affirms in how he structures his gospel in brief, he affirms the meaning of the Lord's Prayer, and he actually thought that he had found something very significant in the way these teachings broke down, that they seem to follow the structure of the Lord's Prayer, or at least in the way that he arranged them.
So another thing, there's this sleight of hand happening sometimes, or an inconsistency, whatever you want to call it. Tolstoy seems to toy with this idea of there isn't actually a God. It's something that's within everyone. But there is a God.
Right.
And he moves between those depending at different times. He wants one or the other. So I was just, interested in that, because a lot of it is actually, a lot of it feels like an atheist interpretation of the Bible.
Yeah.
And one way you could, if you were to write an atheist version of the Bible, I guess, you would take away God and you would say, well, God is humanity or something like that. And that seems to be something that Tolstoy does at times in this.
Yeah, I agree. Like we were saying at the beginning, on the one hand, he has a very materialistic notion. On the other hand, like you're saying, he seems to oscillate between Jesus showing us the way to a much purer understanding of God. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't leave God out. Interestingly, he leaves the Holy Spirit out. He doesn't leave God out. And then sometimes he seems to want to view the embodiment of Jesus' teaching as just a rich inner life that's directed away from material possessions and really material anything, a spiritual life that has no attachment to the world.
There's an interesting thing where he's like, you can find this through my teachings, is what he keeps saying. And that's, I guess, what you're saying is would have been something in the accepted version of the Bible that he would have said, you can find this through me, probably.
Right.
If you're saying,
right,
you know, like as opposed through my teachings. And he keeps saying this, you can find this rich inner life through my teachings. But you don't need to pray. God doesn't really exist. It's within you. You don't need to fast or do any kind of ritual, but you have to believe in me to do this. To me, there's a weird thing. He's saying basically you don't have to do anything to be a Christian, except for believe in me. But then even sometimes he's relaxed about that. He's like, as long as you follow these ideas, then you'll be okay anyway.
Yeah.
So there's kind of like a continually chipping away at what a religion is, really. Like,
right. And it becomes very contemporary, because we'll hear a lot of people say, as, you know, traditional religious institutions lose membership in the 21st century, you'll hear people say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious.
Yeah.
By which they mean maybe they believe in God, or they believe in some kind of higher being, or they believe in ways of achieving inner peace, but they're not going to do it through an institution.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a church or something. So in that sense, Tolstoy is very out in front of the trends by a good, 130 years.
Yeah. That's right. And this is something we've both talked about, because we both dislike that saying a lot. For different reasons.
Yeah.
Maybe the same reason, because essentially if you say, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. No, you are religious. if you're spiritual, no, that's religious. That's straight up religious.
That's fair.
It's not part of an organized religion, sure, and which I guess is their point. But to me, it's still a belief in a spirit, which is to me is one of the cornerstones of religion. Because that's where I separate myself, like as an atheist. Maybe the problem I have when someone says, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual, maybe it's to do with me conflating not religious and atheist in some way. Because as soon as someone says it, I think, well, you're definitely not an atheist, I guess is what it is.
To me, the problem is that their attitude reflects a consumerist approach to spirituality, and consumerism is one of the primary religions of our time. So
that's right.
So if you have a consumerist approach to spirituality, you are both spiritual and religious in the most fundamental sense. But that's I wouldn't like go to the mat on that. I don't want to begrudge anyone any way of being more human, becoming more themselves, you know?
You know, like you've said, it has a consumerist approach because it has like, I can take this bit of Buddhism, I can take this bit of Christianity,
right.
I can, and this is my spirituality, is I can just take the bits I agree with.
Yeah.
It becomes circular. To me, even as a method to becoming more human, it's not ideal because I think you become in touch with your humanity by embracing other humans. I think it's kind of one of the key things. I guess it's not to say you can't use I'm not religious but I am spiritual as a way to embrace more humans, but it doesn't appear an obvious path to me.
Yeah, it's problematic. I feel like we're all in process all the time. And that's why I say I don't want to begrudge anyone finding value in these various belief systems. But I want us all to be aware of what we really believe. And that's been a recurring theme.
I've become fond of telling people, I'm not spiritual, but I am religious. because I think that kind of, like, I don't believe in the spiritual aspect of things at all. But I do believe in social conventions and I guess that's the religious aspect to me rather than the spiritual aspect that puts us in touch with other humans.
Hmm.
I remember thinking this because when I lived in Pittsburgh, I played in the Pittsburgh Russian Balalaika Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it Russian Balalaika Orchestra of Pittsburgh? I don't remember anymore. and often we would play next to Orthodox churches. We would never play in the church because they don't allow instruments in the church.
Uh-huh.
But this was one of the common places the Russian orchestra would play, is in a building connected to an Orthodox church or in the courtyard next to it, or something like that. And the community would come and listen and they enjoyed it. We enjoyed having people listen to our music. And the leader of the orchestra is also an atheist. I would ride with him to the, he was also my ride there and back. And I remember saying something kind of cynical about religion at some point. He's like, the value for me is that it keeps these traditions alive and people have a connection to the heritage and they can come and listen to things that their ancestors might have listened to. And these things, he's like, they wouldn't have survived without the churches to exist. To me, it was like, oh yeah, the religion part definitely has a value in that respect. That's a good way to use it. There's bad ways to use it too, because the same part of that that's like about maintaining traditions can also be used to keep out people who are different to you.
Sure.
And we've talked about this before. Anything can be used for racism. if you're racist, you will use things for racism. but I'm not of a Russian background at all. Yeah, but I was playing in this and I was welcomed in. And I got to experience their traditions with that not being part of my heritage. So, that way the religion was valuable to me.
Yeah.
Without the spiritualism. So I do feel that in some ways I'm not spiritual, but I am religious.
I like
because
that.
As soon as you get into what happens to a soul after death thing, it's like, no, I'm out. I think actually that's what people want to retain when they say as well, where they say I'm religious, but I'm not religious, but I am spiritual, is they're saying I don't want to die. I think at some level they're saying I want to live forever.
Yeah.
And I think that's very much at the heart of people saying that, is that they're scared of death.
I think you're probably very right about that.
And you should be. I'm not particularly scared of death. But
you enjoy living.
I enjoy living, exactly.
When I think about what Tolstoy has done here, the idea of separating out the natural from the supernatural, to me, is problematic for two reasons. One, I already mentioned that I don't think he takes the canonical gospels on their own terms as a starting point, which I think is a healthy starting point for everyone. Let's take this on its own terms and then see where we go from our own standpoints and our own experiences. But the other thing is, I don't like the term miracles. I don't like the term supernatural.
I understand that totally. Actually, just down the road from you in Pittsburgh is the Centre for Postnatural History. And this kind of gets to the point of a lot of the things I think you're saying. So in a Museum of Natural History, and this is the whole point of the Centre for Postnatural History, is a Museum of Natural History is supposed to be things before humans tampered with them, and because that's natural, it's like and so this is the center for things that humans have tampered with. so like, you know, it has things like a taxidermy genetically engineered goat in there, and it has the history of sea monkeys and things like this, which is a very interesting history. If you go there, you should check that out. It involves Nazism, which you don't expect. Anyway, so but there's one of the great things to check out there. But the person who runs it, Rich Powell, is very interested in the unnatural division between natural history and post-natural, and this idea of like you're kind of saying humans are unnatural things, and you're getting at the same thing. The division between natural and supernatural is creating similar uncomfortable divisions between what is of this world and what is not of this world.
Yeah, very much so. And this is something that Tolstoy misses too, like because he wants to dismiss Judaism for whatever reasons. And again, yes. Jefferson too wants to dismiss Judaism.
That stuck out to me, yes. Tolstoy does not like the Jews. And uses the Bible as like a method to beat them over the head.
At least the Gospels. And he wants to maybe see Jesus as a reformer, as someone who's helping Jews break free of the strictures of Judaism. And there's an argument to be made for that. But by embracing this disconnect between the Old and New Testaments, what gets missed is how holistic the Old Testament Hebrew worldview is, and how there is not this dualism between spirit and body, between nature and grace. It's a holistic worldview. And the main reason I object to the idea of miracles is that when Jesus does something to demonstrate his power, it's not that he's trying to prove that he's God. If you read the Gospels, no one had a better sense of confirmation bias than the Gospel writers. Because the people who are open to Jesus see the things he does and respond to him because he's doing the things he does out of compassion for people, for one. But they respond to the things he does. The people who are not open to Jesus, it doesn't matter what he does. They're going to find some other explanation, even attributing it to the devil. The gospel writers understood confirmation bias. This is not a new thing. So what's going on when Jesus does this some kind of work of power to heal someone, to walk on the water, to raise the dead? What's happening here? And if you read it in the context, if you read the Gospels in the context of the Hebrew scriptures, it becomes really clear that Jesus is reclaiming God's creation from the bondage of sin. That's what's going on there. He's taking back creation, and he's healing not just our inner life, which is what Tolstoy wants to focus on. He's healing our bodies. He's healing our environment. He's healing our social and political systems.
I see. So you're saying in this holistic view, you can't actually heal one without the other.
Yeah, very much. There's no heaven where you're floating around in the clouds. That's Disney. That's not the Bible. The teleology of the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament, is not that we're moving towards some kind of disembodied spiritual bliss. That's Gnosticism. The teleology of the Bible is that we're moving toward a renewed creation, and that we are being renewed in our capacity to bear God's image in the creation. And the title that Jesus gives himself, Son of Man, is an apocalyptic title, and it just means human one. In other words, he's the embodiment of what it means to be human, and that includes having authority in creation for life-giving purposes. If I'm being heavy-handed, it's because the people who frustrate me the most in failing to understand this are Christians. I've heard Christians defending the supernatural as this is some kind of biblical imperative. And no, the idea of the supernatural is actually foreign to scriptures. And I don't think we should even use the term miracle. I think when Jesus does some kind of work of power, we should call it a recreative act. Or even an act of reclamation. And that way, we're at least more consistent with all of the Old Testament scriptures that precede the Gospels, and out of which, and Jesus is clearly working out of his understanding of the Old Testament and out of his understanding of Torah. So I understand why Tolstoy misses this, because most Christians miss this. And I don't mean to set myself up. I didn't come up with this myself, right? I'm not claiming this is my gnosis. No, I'm just saying that this is a minority view within Christianity that doesn't buy into the kind of Platonic dualisms that have driven so much of Christian theology for the last couple millennia. And the Gospels, the recreative acts make the teachings fit together so well when you understand them in this holistic way. This is probably a good place to stop for me. I'll just quit while I'm behind.
should we go on to the other section?
What are we calling it? So for this week's episode of we're going to talk about an issue that is anathema to our hearts. You know how some things are dear to your heart? Well, these are subjects that are anathema to our hearts, right? Explain this, Neil.
Okay, so these are actually words that I came across upon arriving in America. They're not used that I know of in New Zealand or the UK, the two previous places I've lived. And one is the word impactful. And the other is the word addicting. And it's not how grammatically horrible they seem to me that I dislike them for, but it's actually that there's a weird fascism in those terms that bothers me. So if something, to say something is impactful misses what it has an impact on. If something has an impact, it has an impact on something.
Yeah.
To say it's impactful just says in general it has impact. So yeah. It's just like this thing will have impact on whatever. It misses the object. That's the problem with it.
Can we just lay out something really clearly? Impact is a noun. Something makes an impact. It's a noun.
Now, it makes an impact on something.
It makes an impact on something else. Now, I understand that language is fluid and usage is what determines usage, right? So after many, many years of fighting this, I've grown to accept impact as a verb because there's something about impact, right? Impact. It's like kind of onomatopoeic, right?
Yeah, yeah. And something could impact on something, you know, it's like...
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we could use it as a verb. For a long time, I fought against any kind of usage except X will have an impact, you know. But I've grown to accept impact as a verb because when you say that will really impact such and such, then it captures the forcefulness of the concept. You know, it captures the kind of kinetic quality of the word.
But when you take away what it's acting on, then you just wind up with something is just objectively has impact. And then it becomes a problem.
And the word itself has no onomatopoeic quality, right? Impactful. Impactful. It like takes away all the impact of the word impact and turns it into a slushy of a word.
And this thing is full of impact.
Why not say impactatious? Like I feel like that has a lot more oomph than impactful or impactative.
But the problem to me comes if you say this movie is impactful, and I say it had no impact on me, then am I saying it's not impactful? Because apparently it was objectively impactful, you know, so it had to have an impact on
that's me. True, right?
And that's I think where the hidden fascism is if it's impactful, it kind of suggests to me that it has impact on everything. It's just is objectively containing impact.
And
there's things it will not have impact on, and it will not forever have impact. These are very reliant on context. It removes the context.
That's a really good point. I understand your point about hidden fascism much more. I just have a very strong dislike for impactful, but you've made a very cogent political argument about why it's just horrible.
It's the same with addicting.
Oh.
Like, these are addicting. No, you find them addictive. They are not addicting. Something addicts you to it. Again, it's a relationship as part of this idea of something being addictive. And if it's addicting, you're removing that relationship. You're just putting it solely into the object.
Yeah.
And yes, I might also find it addictive, but I might not. Like,
Right. I agree. Like, the way we use these words, and I get that language is fluid. I get that usage is determinative. But I also feel like a lot of this less thoughtful usage comes from, like, the world of sports color commentators who kind of know a word but don't know how to use it. And good for them. I understand the value of color commentary, but then it's clearly too impactful on the English language as a whole.
And I think business language is another thing that maybe these things come from.
Yeah. You know who uses impactful? I didn't realize this until I was helping my mother-in-law download Office 365 onto her laptop. Impactful applications is right, like their tagline now for Office 365.
Holy shit. What I would say is, language moves, and also it's not perfect, but it is capable of greater accuracy than it's often used with. And we should strive to have that. And so if something can impact something, have an impact on something, or if something is addictive to you, be clear of what is happening to it. It can't just happen to everything.
Agreed. Well, there's our question. Should I really care about this?
Yeah. These are all hills I will die on, Phil.
And I respect that. I agree. I should really care about this. And I do.